Guess who's back? It's your boy, E. Marcel Portute. Hope all of you have done well out there. Long time since I've done a podcast for you. Really miss talking to all of you out there. I'm going to get into details of why I took a little bit of a sporkation. Personal reasons, professional reasons, and everything in between. But all is good here in North Atlanta. Have a really excited show for you tonight. First, we're going to talk about, give a recap of the last UFC event. And Anderson Silva finally going down. Have some thoughts on that. And also the state of MMA right now. We're going to go over some NBA free agency. Do a slight recap of the NBA finals. Going to delve into the internationalization of professional sports. I was watching Wimbledon and watching some of the Gold Cup for the CONCACAF in soccer. And it got me, I brewed up some thoughts there. Also going to talk about some general topics. Major League Baseball All-Star Game is actually taking place tonight. So by the time a lot of you listen to this, it's going to be done and over with. But I'm going to delve into really the state of Major League Baseball as well. And then finally, just talk about some miscellaneous news and notes. And we're going to get into an interesting Ruffling My Feathers edition. We are bringing that segment back. It's very popular with a lot of you out there that listen to the show. So it is going to return. So once again, enjoy the ride. And when I come back, I am going to delve into mixed martial arts here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. To the Sports Inquirer podcast. Once again, your host, E. Marcel Portute. As always, if you want to communicate with me and the website, you can always go to thesportsinquirer.net, and from there you will find all the information about the podcast, some of our blog postings. We're going to have some good content, UFC, MMA, UFC related in the next week or so. Going to delve into my MMA power rankings. Also going to talk about some Major League Baseball, the second half of the season, so we're going to do some write-ups on that. And everything in between. Had to get that Sabu music in from ECW. And the reason I played that music, usually I play the Fedor when I talk about MMA. I dedicated this weekend to staying home and staying inside and working on the podcast as far as doing some outlining, maybe some target audiences and some future shows, things like that. Unfortunately, YouTube is my biggest deterrent and my biggest distractor. I don't know how I delved into old ECW Extreme Championship Wrestling matches, and from there, I think I was looking for promos for Joel Gertner, who was a legendary manager for the promotion. From there, I think I saw some Taz content, and from Taz, who is probably one of my favorite wrestlers of all time, I ended up delving to Sabu, and I saw a two-hour documentary in the middle of a Saturday night on Sabu, who is another one of my favorite wrestlers of all time. That was his theme song, his walkout music, and it really killed my night. I mean, I should be out there hitting the Atlanta streets hard, partying, or reading a book or something, and I'm sitting there watching a documentary on wrestling from the early to mid-1990s. But that was my heyday. I loved it. And it kind of relates to MMA in a way, because while I'm really passionate about mixed martial arts right now, and I still follow my professional wrestling with TNA for personal relationship reasons, and WWE and Ring of Honor at times, MMA was really the sport that kind of deterred me from wrestling, professional wrestling, for a really long time. And the ECW factor growing up in Brooklyn, New York, and having access to all of those shows was a big factor. But now, being down here in Atlanta, I really don't delve into wrestling as much. I still watch Raw, and we'll have a wrestling segment on the next show where I'll get into the state of WWE and TNA. But transitioning, long story short, going back to Sabu, and now with mixed martial arts, it represented kind of, watching that documentary showed where my head was at back in the mid-90s when I was a teenager. And I don't know if I would have been as big a wrestling fan if mixed martial arts was as big as it was then, or now, as it was now, as if it was big back then. So it was interesting watching that this weekend. But let's get into the recent UFC event. Anderson Silva went down, his first loss in 17 UFC contests, or his last clean loss in a fight since December of 2004, when he lost in Pride against Ryo Chonin. And even me, as a MMA follower and expert, I am not too familiar with Ryo. So that just shows how long ago it was. And I thought about the Tao of Anderson Silva. Now, looking at the word Tao and how it relates to fighting, I look at it as the mindset, the state of mind. And there's only been a handful of fighters in any combat sport, whether it's boxing, mixed martial arts, and things like that, who can relate to the plight, or not the plight, but the mindset of a champion like Anderson Silva, where you get to the point where, and still Dana White's line, he's not used to losing. And it gets to the point where you feel you're so dominant over your opponent, you need to find ways to entertain yourself. And I'm going to get into an example I saw when, bad matter of fact, in the mid-90s, of a fighter who would do this, and he got caught, and he ended up getting his revenge. But back to Silva, the showboating, if you saw the fight, the showboating caught up with them against Chris Weidman, who, respectfully, a lot of people picked him win the fight, including Georges St. Pierre and a lot of other experts. I put on Facebook that evening before the evening of the fight, before the pay-per-view started, that I was interested in taking Weidman to win the fight. I just did not see a way that Silva was going to lose. And that was a big mistake on my part, because if there's anything we've learned from combat sports, and you can go down the line to Mike Tyson losing to Buster Douglas, we'll get to another boxing example, more contemporary version, more within the past 20 years or so. When you get into a sport where men are hitting each other with their fists and legs and trying to knock each other out, anything can happen. And Weidman earned that fight. And that's another people talking about, was the fight fixed? I don't think it was fixed for several reasons. One, as much as we like to make fun as boxing fans of certain promoters having sway over who wins a fight, who loses a fight, the selection of judges, the referee selection, all of that stuff, I'm not saying that mixed martial arts or the UFC and Zuffa as a company is immune to that. I think anytime you involve gambling in any sport, I don't care if it is your local WNBA contest or cricket or highlight, horse racing, anything that people are putting money down, a buck for someone to win or lose or to finish faster than somebody else, the corruption potential is always strong. So while I think the match was not fixed, because I think with the factor of it being in Las Vegas, the UFC, despite all of the growth that it has had and the potential growth of the future, I don't think that would risk maybe the best fighter ever to fight in the promotion, and maybe the best fighter in all of mixed martial arts history. I don't think they're going to have him lose a fight just to come back later on. I know the rematch was announced for late December, against New Year's Eve weekend, and they're going to fight again for the title. I don't think that they would risk a loss just to get a rematch and get an ultimate gain in that. And furthermore, I don't think Silva, it's like going back to the mindset of a champion, I don't think he would take a dive for any amount of financial money in the state that he's in. He's an older fighter. He knows he only has about, I know he signed a 10-fight contract. He's only going to see about 3 or 4 of those because he is getting older. He has a legacy to live up to, and he is not going to throw a fight, especially in a title match, just to get a few extra amounts of money. Now, as I said, corruption is always a factor. You can't deny the elephant in the room with gambling and sports, but I don't think that was a factor in that. Now, looking at the future for him, I did my outline before the rematch was announced. I thought it was interesting after Weidman won the joy and glee of the middleweight division in the UFC. Vitor Belfort, Mark Munoz, Michael Bisping, all throwing their hat in, trying to get a fight against Weidman. And to Weidman's credit, he kept very quiet about it and didn't tip his hat if he wanted to rematch with Silva again or if he wanted to fight a new challenger. He was very coy about it. And as I said, now it's been announced that in the later UFC event, Silva is going to fight again for the title against Weidman. This reminded me really of, and only boxing fans out there can relate to this, Roy Jones Jr. I remember when Roy Jones fought Montel Griffin for a light heavyweight title back in 1997. And this is when Jones was at his peak. Similar to Silva, Anderson Silva, Jones was very defensive, elusive, pulling all of the tricks of just standing in front of the opponent with his hands down, using a lot of verbal and mental strategies to try to get the opponent off his pace and everything like that. Jones ended up losing that fight to Griffin the first fight because of an illegal punch while Griffin was down. Griffin had a knee down and Jones punched him. Similar to Silva with his fighting as Yushin Okami with the illegal strike. So technically, Montel Griffin won the fight. But I think all of us out there are watching it, and Jones was dominating and getting his in. I mean, Griffin was a tough fighter. He got his shots in as well. But if you're looking at it from a scoring perspective, Jones dominated that first fight. But in the end, he lost because of the rules. And the rules are there for a reason. And the rematch was announced immediately. And I remember this fight personally. This was back in 97. This was a time when finally got HBO in the house back in New York. And I think the fight was on HBO. And I was new to potential for witnessing greatness. That sound very overdramatic and cliche-ic. I knew the chance for that was going to happen during that fight. And Jones was always criticized, similar to Silva. Remember when Anderson Silva fought Damian Maia? He could have ended that fight in the first round if he wanted to. But he dragged it out all 5 rounds, really was passive, and disappointed a lot of viewing public with that display. And Jones was getting the same critiques back in the mid to late 90s because there were fighters he could have knocked out in the first or second round, but he kept it going the 7-8 rounds, really toying with his opponent and making them look silly, similar to what Silva has done against numerous fighters over his UFC career. So the second fight takes place. I said, I'm home, got the popcorn, got the soft drink, watching the fight. And you could just tell the mentality. And even with George Foreman and Jim Lampley just talking about it, you could tell the mentality was, we're going to see a first-round knockout. He is not going to mess around. And sure enough, Jones, first minute or so, was pacing, getting the jab together. You saw none of the showboating. Knocked down Griffin. It's on YouTube. It's a really good fight to watch. Knocked down Griffin. Griffin stumbled back towards the ropes, grabbed the ropes to stay up, and that counted as the first knockdown. About 30 seconds later, Jones hit one of the nastiest left-handed uppercuts I've ever seen in a fight. And it floored Griffin immediately. Fight was over 2 minutes in. That was maybe the most dominant boxing performance I've ever seen from a fighter at his absolute peak. And the whole background of it with the loss by an illegal punch in the first fight added to the drama. Weidman's a tough dude. I mean, he's very respectable. He's trained by an excellent camp up in New York. If Silva's motivated, I think he could pull off a Roy Jones Jr. And we have all the way to December to talk about that fight. But watching that first fight and their reaction afterwards remind me of that night. So all my boxing heads out there, I know you could definitely relate to it. We'll go over the rest of the card real quick. Frankie Edgar got back on the winning track with a solid win over Charles Oliveira. He's kind of stuck. He can go back to lightweight, but he's starting to look very small, especially faces Benson Henderson. If Henderson wins his fight against Pettis later on this year, I don't know if he's going to go to featherweight or flyweight or anything like that, but Edgar finally got a win off of his 3-fight losing streak. Mark Munoz, very impressive win over Tim Bosch. Speaking of middleweights who were vying for the crown since Weidman has it, Munoz, if you followed him on Twitter and on the internet, went through some struggles health-wise. He has gained a significant amount of weight for fighting standards, and lost a lot of weight, got healthy, and looked really impressive over Bosch. I think he's going to be a major contender for that middleweight crown, even if Silva gets it back. That's definitely a fight that I and a lot of other fans want to see. Cub Swanson, nice technical knockout over Dennis Seaver. Cub is an interesting fighter, too. We've had the full influx of the WEC guys coming into the UFC. Jose Aldo, Uriah Faber. We've had those guys. They're fully acclimated into the UFC because since that merger took place almost 2 years ago now, maybe more than 2 years ago. Seems like it was really yesterday when Zuffa bought WEC and the merge took place. Swanson's kind of one of those guys who made his trade in the WEC and some other promotions, and not within the UFC. He's kind of one of the last guys that did that. And now that he has a 5 or 6 match winning streak, he really deserves, I think, a shot at the crown. But we'll see what happens with Aldo and the Korean Zombie later on this month. But I think whoever wins that fight, Swanson really should get a crack at the belt. So those are my UFC or MMA thoughts overall. We're going to hit up Bellator next episode because I have watched some of Fight Master on Spike, and I really like what I'm seeing. And we're going to delve into that a little bit more, probably in my Thursday episode. I really like the potential of that show. Very intriguing. The judges really having to sell themselves to the fighters. I like that twist. You know, and we'll delve into that a lot more as a next episode. And if you have any thoughts on that show or anything mixed martial arts related or wrestling related in general, please send us an email once again to sportsinquirer@gmail.com. On Twitter, my handle is sportsinquirer, all one word. You can also look us up on Facebook under The Sports Inquirer. Or look me up in ATN Marcel Portu. Just look me up and friend me, and that gives you links to a lot of my tweets and other things as well from the site. We're going to take a break here, and when I come back, I'm going to delve into NBA free agency and quick recap of the NBA Finals that took place between the Spurs and the Heat here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. You know, the big inspiration for my sportcation, trying to figure out what the trademark or the term would be for when you take a break from sports. The big impetus for that really relates to my next topic, the backdoor cut, and in the NBA. back when the NBA Finals was going on between San Antonio and Miami, the Heat ended up winning Game 7. Excellent performance from both sides. I thought the Spurs put up a really good fight. Really should have won Game 6. Letting those offensive rebounds by Chris Bosh ultimately doom them, especially that Ray Allen 3 to help get the game and clinch it for Miami. You know, and as I said, that happened a while ago, so I'm not going to delve too much into details about that. What I will talk about, though, is what ended up happening was just the overload of information with between the LeBron James constant talk about what's going on with him and then all of the talk with the legacy and where is Tim Duncan rank all time. And if the Heat, every time they won a game, it was like this is Heat are going to three-peat and match the Bulls and all-time stuff. Every time Miami would lose, the Heat are going to break up, trade Bosh, Wade, his career is over, his legs are gone. Just a constant over-analysis of the series made me take a break from watching all sports networks, including the four-letter network, and you know which one that is, all the sports talk stations here in Atlanta. And no disrespect to those guys. I mean, all of them have jobs to do, and I'm a sports professional, so I understand what it is to have that career and try to get to the highest level. But I went to a hip-hop show on Game 7. I missed the entire contest. Matter of fact, it was a good show. It was at Terminal West, nice facility here in Atlanta. Good show. Saw a lot of good DJs. Interesting hip-hop scene. I wasn't the oldest guy in the crowd, thankfully. That was my biggest fear, of being the oldest person there. But there are a lot of college-age students, and it was like, man, and I'm 32. I have no shame in my age. I love my age, and I'm happy to be how old I am. But it really puts some perspective on it, because when you're at the bar and you're standing next to someone, you're like, okay, she's cute, she's interesting, and you realize she's doesn't even have the... Because when you go to an over-age show, and all of you out there know this, you get little colored wristband that says you're over age 21, which means you can be served drinks. When half the crowd doesn't even have that wristband on, meaning that they're under 21, you know you're the old person in the group. But there were some senior citizens, some older folks in there, people in their 50s and 60s, at the event. So I respect that. Creative Loafing did a good job promoting it. But anyway, I didn't watch Game 7. It sounded like it was a really good game. I saw the highlights. I'm a sports analyst, so I did see what I needed to see. But taking that sports break, and it lasted about a week before I really started getting back to slowly listening to more sports talk shows and going to the blogs and going to some of the news sites, it gave me some good perspective. I loved it. I was reading more. I was watching some other television content, some nature shows, reading some science articles. I was so happy I took that break from it. And now that I'm back into it, I really like sports again. I always like sports. And I've never rejected it. Something I've been following since I was literally able to comprehend words and read letters. I've been following sports, reading sports pages for 20, 30 years now. But anyway, going back to the finals with LeBron James winning, or Elite winning Game 7, and now he has two titles and two in a row, and they're probably getting a chance to win three in a row, depending on how things shake out. Good job by Miami. We'll have plenty of time to analyze all of that stuff when season opens up. But this is a fun season, though, as far as the offseason with free agency and trades. I'm going to break down things I liked and what I didn't like. And I'm going to go back and forth a little bit with it, and you'll kind of see where I'm going with it. Here's what I liked. Dwight Howard going to the Houston Rockets. He was very melodramatic about his departure from Orlando, and I was his biggest critic of wanting to be traded, but then not being traded, signing a tenured deal or a contract to stay with the team the rest of the year, and then all of a sudden want to be traded to the Lakers. All that drama back and forth. I think in the end, he made a good basketball decision, which is strange saying someone made a good basketball decision leaving the Los Angeles Lakers. And love him or hate him, the Lakers are one of the marquee franchises in the entire world, not just in NBA or in the North America, in the entire world. You look at all of the major franchises that are internationally recognized for various reasons. You look at Manchester United. You look at Real Madrid. The New York Yankees to a lesser extent. And the Los Angeles Lakers are in that top five in whatever teams you name, because basketball is an international sport. And he left that, and not only did he leave, he left money on the table to go to Houston Rockets. And I know they talk about the taxes that are, the no state tax in Texas, and sure, that is a factor. But he left a franchise that traditionally, you know, outside of the little post-Magic Johnson retirement era pre-Kobe, and even then they were a playoff team with Saddell Threed and Eddie Jones and Nick Van Exel. You make it seem like that era was just like the dark days for the Los Angeles Lakers. They still were a playoff team, and then Shaq and Kobe went there, and we know what happened with that. So if you sign with the Lakers, you know within the next 4 or 5 years, you're going to be contending for an NBA championship. And what seemed like Howard, that'd be his biggest goal as far as his basketball legacy or trying to compete. Because at a certain stage, you never turn down the dollar. I understand that as far as getting financially compensated for whatever you do. But when you're at the level of Howard, you've been Defensive Player of the Year. You've been to one NBA Finals appearance with Orlando. At this stage of your career, you're in your late 20s or mid to late 20s. It's time to start putting some hardware as far as NBA championships into your mantle. And you would think with the Lakers, that'd be the best opportunity. But the way the Lakers are operating right now with the Buss family, you don't know about Kobe Bryant, his recovery from injury. You don't know how long he's going to even play when he comes back. Just the uncertainty of the entire Lakers situation. I think it was a shrewd move to go to Houston and play with James Harden. And you got Chandler Parsons and a few other players, Jeremy Lin, who I think is actually going to work really well with Dwight Howard, and a few other players that they have in Houston. It's a 4-year deal also, which is really good because he's still going to be in line for another big contract. So if it doesn't work out after 3 or 4 years, he can just go to another team. What I didn't like is Josh Smith signing a 4-year, $56 million deal with Detroit. And when I say I don't like these deals, it's not for the player. Because once again, if you're a player, get as much money as you can. You know, feed your family, get compensated. All that's beautiful. But I'm looking at it from an NBA executive perspective. Dealing with the Josh Smith era here in Atlanta and seeing the inconsistencies, the ups and downs, the games where he puts up 20 and 15, post up, defensive presence, looks like one of the best forwards in the NBA. And then some nights where he just goes 3 for 10 from the field, shooting perimeter jumpers, trying to be a point forward in the middle of the third quarter for some reason. Just a lack of consistency from him. And now you're giving him 4 years and all of that money, especially when you have Greg Monroe and Andre Drummond in the front court, who I think are going to be a fun group to work with. And I've seen the stories where I guess I'm going to try to put Josh Smith at small forward, Monroe at power forward, and Drummond at center. While that's a beefy front court, and that may win you some games and make you a potential playoff team, the lack of perimeter shooting on that squad, and hopefully they need to make some more moves to get some shooters, that's really going to mess them up in the long run. And I'm just concerned with him, with Smith getting the money and becoming complacent. Or this, especially as a team like Detroit, where he needed to be with, I think, a veteran squad, San Antonio, Boston before all of it. And we'll get to the Boston situation in a moment, but a team with Doc Rivers and the veterans around him where he can't get away with a lot of the freelancing that he normally does. But good for him to sign that contract, but I think the Pistons are really going to be in trouble with that. I liked what the Clippers did, re-signing Chris Paul. We knew that they had to make that happen. That was obvious. So I liked that move. Getting J.J. Redick was a good move as well. He had to trade away Eric Bledsoe, which you don't want to do, but he was getting logjammed behind Chris Paul. So that was a really solid move to get J.J. Redick to get some shooting. A 3-year deal for Matt Barnes. That's pretty much the Small forward Kevin Durant stopper move there, and I like it. Barnes is a really gritty defender, really solid player overall. I don't like Paul Millsap signing a two-year, $19 million deal in Atlanta. If you're going to play the rebuilding game, and I like Millsap, he was a solid player for Utah, that's not the answer for Atlanta, signing him to a $10 million deal. He's a good player, but he's a limited player. Hawks, they need a center. And Millsap, while he's a beefy guy, you still have two power forwards pretty much trying to divvy up the center responsibilities. That's not going to work in the long run. I like Andre Iguodala going to Golden State on a four-year deal. They need a perimeter defender. They have enough shooters. They got Curry. They got Thompson. Harrison Barnes came on in the playoffs. They can get points. Jared Jack losing him hurts, but Iguodala is a versatile player, can dribble, handle some of the ball, handling responsibilities. I really like that choice for Golden State. Jose Calderon getting 4 years and $28 million to Dallas. And just to dip, and with Dallas along as well, we'll talk about them getting Monty Ellis. Why do you have a starting backcourt of Calderon and Ellis? Two players who are limited in their capabilities. We've seen the Calderon. We know what he is. Toronto every year would just hope he'd make that turn and make that move. That didn't happen. Ellis shoots the ball a lot. Very selfish player on the court. That's not going to work very well. I like David West going to Indiana. 3 years, $36 million. Perfect team for the perfect player for their system. Good money. That works out. OJ Mayo, 3 years, $24 million to Milwaukee. Don't like that move. I like Mayo. Kind of redeemed his career because he kind of had an odd ending in Memphis to start off his career. Went to Dallas, redeemed himself a little bit. Still, I don't think that's gonna be good money for Milwaukee, who now Brendan Jennings doesn't want to go back there. And I kind of understand. Milwaukee's in a really tough spot. I guess they're in full tank mode, so we'll see what happens there. Similar to David West, Thiago Splitter, 4 years, $36 million with the Spurs. Tim Duncan can't play forever. He's going to retire within 4 years, and you get a center who knows that system very well for a decent market rate. So, good move for them. Kevin Martin, 4 years, $28 million to Minnesota. That's going to be a lot. He's going to get some shots. Rubio's going to pass him the ball, but that backcourt defense is going to struggle. But the biggest thing with Minnesota, they got to get their front court healthy. Petkovic, they got to re-sign him or figure that out. And then Kevin Love has to stay on the court. So unless Kevin Love stays on the court, nothing's really going to happen too much with them. Tony Allen, I like Tony Allen going 4 years for $20 million to Memphis. Similar to David West and Thiago Splitter. Perfect man for that system. Good pay rate. Approved. Tyreke Evans, 4 years, $44 million to New Orleans. Pelicans are trying to make their presence felt with the draft and Anthony Davis. I don't see how that move is going to help. I guess they figure maybe the Austin Rivers-Evans backcourt can help, but both of those guys have tried to be point guards at various points of their career, and that has not happened. So until they figure out how to get that going, that's not going to work too well. Martell Webster, 4 years, $22 million from the Washington Wizards. Bless their hearts. Portland fans out there know that Webster is an illusion. He's going to give you one good game for every five or six played. He'll hit four or five three-pointers, and you think, man, this is going to be our consistent outside threat. And then it doesn't happen. That's going to be some money that's going to hurt them. Al Jefferson, four-year deal in Charlotte. I understand that the Bobcats have to make these type of moves to get anything going for that struggling franchise. But you're going to take a guy with an injury history and make him your marquee guy. That's a really tough move for me to swallow if I'm a Bobcats fan. But, I mean, it's an upgrade over what they had, but they may have had the worst roster in the entire NBA. So I guess anything is better than nothing. And then finally, the last thing I did not like, J.R. Smith, four-year deal with the New York Knicks. J.R. Smith is a player that you need to have on constant one- or two-year deals. You need a one-year deal because you know he's going to be inconsistent or whatever. And that second year, you're going to get the contract year. He's going to ball his heart out and everything like that. They signed him to a four-year deal. He was a sixth man of the year. He had a good regular season. postseason, especially again that Boston series, towards the middle of that series, and then eventually later on in the playoffs, struggled big time, especially against Indiana. And then he now has a knee injury, going to be out 3 to 4 months. I know, so that means he may be back for training camp and everything like that. But anytime you have NBA player plus knee injury, I want no part of that. So Knicks are in trouble with that contract. So, and they also signed Meta World Peace, a.k.a. our boy Ron Artest. Q Burrow is back in the building. If you're going to make these moves, I don't understand where they're trying to go with this, because they're taking on money that they're going to mess up when the next free agency period takes place in the next 2 years. Because free agency in 2014 and 15 are going to be intriguing. You're going to have a lot of major players out there. All three of the Miami Heat stars, Dirk Nowitzki, and a cast of others. And if you keep on taking this money, you're going to have no money to sign them. Carmelo Anthony is going to be a free agent at that time. So I don't know what the Knicks' motive is with making these choices with their signings. But that's what I liked and didn't like so far from the NBA free agency period still going on. There are still a few players lurking to be signed. We're going to take another break here, and when I come back, I'm going to talk about the internationalization of sports in the United States and worldwide here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. Welcome back to the Sports Inquirer podcast, host E. Marcel Portuit, as always. I thought about the internationalization. There we go. I said it correctly. Yes, I'm struggling with that word. I don't know if it's a real word. We'll see. My English teachers back in high school and college are shaking their heads right now with it. But anyway, I thought about how the international game has really crossed over into the United States watching Wimbledon 2 weeks ago, or 2 weekends ago, when Andy Murray finally won that title for all of Great Britain, and all the reaction for what happened from there. And every time there's a major tournament in tennis these days, there's the talk of where are all of the all-timers as far as American players. Where's our Pete Sampras, our Andre Agassi, our John McEnroe, Jimmy Connors, Arthur Ashe, on the men's side at least, and where on the women's side, where's our Martina Navratilova when she became an American, or Chris Everett, or all that stuff. And obviously on the women's side, we have maybe the best player ever all time, or at least in the top five if you made a ranking, Serena Williams, who has really had a good career revitalization and everything like that. But then let's look at the men's side. The highest ranked men's tennis player, I'll give you a minute to think about it, is actually John Isner, who's actually a local product here from the state of Georgia. He's ranked 19th in the nation. If you look at the highest ranked women's player, American women's player besides Serena Williams, you got to go all the way down to 16 with Sloane Stephens. Now, I thought about it and I was like, why should this matter? Similar to certain topics in sports, and we've delved into baseball with the lack of minority players or black players in baseball and MLB, and the issues of all the initiatives that the MLB has tried to make as far as getting more black players involved and everything like that. And my response has always been, the game is more international than ever. If you include, for at least we're talking baseball here, if you include the Asian players from all the Asian countries, and obviously the South America and the Caribbean, the league has never been more international and more diverse than it is right now. And I think baseball is better for it. You have more of an international interest in the game. And then tie it into tennis, at least in the United States, I think the men's top players, if you look at the top four, while they all represent their European countries very well, they may as well be from the United States as far as media coverage and attention. I see Rafael Nadal in just as much content as I would see Pete Sampras in back in the 90s. Roger Federer is just as known, I think, at his peak as Andre Agassi was when he was playing here in the United States. We actually talk about Andy Murray and a man named Djokovic from Serbia, and just in a normal way. Now, the biggest reason for that, though, I think, is television and just the availability. The only barrier that separates a sports fan from a product is language. Look at the English Premier League, or look at football or soccer here in the United States. English Premier League has a tremendous following in the United States because of the lack of a language barrier. Now, if you follow international soccer in the leagues, you can make a contention that the Spanish League, La Liga, the German League, the Bundesliga, or Serie A in Italy have just as good or maybe better quality players and teams than the English Premier League. However, with those other leagues, a lot of people will struggle comprehending Spanish, German, and Italian. However, if you watch the EPL, it's in England or Great Britain. Got to acknowledge that Swansea City is Welsh. So you have, you know, a Great Britain league where English is the primary language, and there's never an issue as far as what the commentators are saying or what the language is, and I don't understand what the call is and everything like that. I think we're starting to reach that point with tennis as well, where I've been to the U.S. Open, being in New York, I've seen that. I've never been to Paris. I'd love to go to Paris to see the French Open. I've never been to Australia for the Australian Open. I've never even been to England or to the London area to see Wimbledon. However, with television and the internet and other access points, I feel like I'm just as part of the experience as if I'm as close as you can be without being at the actual event. And I think that's what's happening with sports fans today, at least in my generation, where you don't... Would it be nice to have a United States player be in the top five and contending for major crowns? If you want to get really patriotic about it, sure. I think that'd be really good, I guess, for fans who look at those type of things. I personally have never looked... I mean, I'll cheer for the United States in a lot of events because I am an American and I'm proud of my country and I like to see them do well. But I'm not going to not cheer for a country or a player from a certain country because of their background. And maybe that's the culture I'm in. I think a lot of people are still holding on to, especially the older fans. And that's where you see a lot of the media analysts and other fans talking about it. If you listen to radio commentary and read the blogs or read the writings, it seems like it's a lot of older fans are holding on to that Cold War era, that 60s, 70s, and early 80s mentality, where it's like, if it's not a United States player or participant, I cannot cheer for them. I appreciate patriotism just as much as the next person. And as I said, I like seeing the United States win in a lot of competitions. And trust me, I get very passionate about the United States men's and women's national teams for soccer and the Olympics with ice hockey. A lot of sports, I follow the United States and want them to win very, very badly. But I'm not going to reject the greatness of other players because they're from another country. And I said, maybe that's a generational thing, me being a younger guy. But I don't, and just to wrap it all together, I don't see the problem with the United States maybe not having a top five player contending on the men's side and not having another player besides Serena Williams competing on the women's side. Because I think the internationalization of the game with television and internet has made that less of an issue. I can literally, if I wanted to, pull up a soccer match in Asia or a cricket contest in India, or if I wanted to see the Africa Cup of Nations competition when that's going on, I have access to it. Now, I may have to pay a lot of money for it and know there's certain sites and download some things and figure it out, but I have the opportunity to do that. And my generation, I think, is starting to realize that. And guys younger than me who are even better at it as far as finding out all of the content, I think that's made the world a little more globalized and made it not a big deal. And kind of tying into it as well, I've seen the advertisement for the EPL on NBC Sports Network. They better not fuck that up or mess it up, because Fox Sports, for all of the good things that they've done with UFC and bringing that more to the mainstream, I think their NFL coverage is very good. And if I had to choose a network that carries NFL as far as the best one that does it, as far as technology and pregame show and the whole package, I think that Fox does it the best, which really is not saying much, but that's a good thing, respectable. They have been terrible with the English Premier League as far as providing content for people. I don't have Fox Sports Soccer Channel. Sorry, I'm trying to ball on a budget. I'm a little cheap, or whatever you want to say it. When 85 to 90% of your content is on a paid sports network, that is not the way to grow the game. And that is not the way to expand your audience. And watching the random replay on a Monday or Tuesday night or Tuesday morning of a match I already know took place, that's a problem. So hopefully with the NBC Sports Network, they've done a really good job with ice hockey and promoting that, getting to the Stanley Cup Finals, and the ratings were very good. They're gaining some momentum in some other sports and other aspects. Anything they do will be 10 times better than what Fox did with their content. So, as I said, they better not F it up. I think it's my first curse in the podcast. I'm very passionate. I got an F word in. Hey, it's uncensored, but I'm not a cursing guy. But that they better not mess that up and do a bad job presenting that content, because there's so much potential. And there's going to be a really good EPL year. And we'll get to a preview maybe the next week or two. A lot of turnover outside of Alex Ferguson retiring from Manchester United. It's the potential to be one of the more intriguing years in the EPL. But to conclude that as well, just having the opportunity to watch the English Premier League and check it out from my home in Atlanta on a consistent basis if I wanted to make those steps, I think that shows just the international tone of sports today. So those are my thoughts on that. If you have any opinions on it, please send me an email to sportsinquirer@gmail.com. Or leave me a message on the Sports Inquirer, the sportsinquirer.net. Leave a message on the message boards or anything like that. But when I come back, this is our final break. We're going to delve into Major League Baseball a little bit with the All-Star Game taking place very, very soon. Actually, less than an hour from now, here on the Sports Inquirer podcast.
Take a look at these.
One of the big traditions when I was a younger man was watching the Major League Baseball All-Star Game. And we're talking the late 80s to early 90s when I was still in elementary school, delving into middle school a little bit. And this was pre-interleague play. Biggest part about the Major League Baseball All-Star Game, well, two things. One was always watching to see the Mets players do well, whether it was Dwight Gooden or Howard Johnson for a little while, Darryl Strawberry, and heading, you know, later on down the line. Always wanted to see the Mets player do well. And the second thing was always watching to see all of the different players. Back when I didn't have cable, I didn't get cable to the really the mid-90s, I was always intrigued to see Ken Griffey Jr., Cal Ripken, Kirby Puckett, you know, just going down the line, seeing some of the stars from that era, Ivan Rodriguez, and seeing the mix of the uniforms, and not usually didn't have a chance to watch a lot of their games. And the reason I name I was a Mets fan, so I followed the National League games. So a lot of the National League players I was a little bit more familiar with. But the American League guys, I didn't watch too many Yankee games. I wanted to see the American League players that you hear about or you read about in Sports Illustrated or Sporting News, or even you saw the great stats and the baseball cards, getting nostalgic here. That, to me, was the biggest allure of it. And now, I haven't watched a full MLB All-Star game in maybe 15, 20 years. And there are two big reasons for that, and it ties into my previous statement. First one, I got cable. The beauty of cable, I just did my last segment, I was talking about internationalization. By the way, if that's the word in the drinking game, y'all are hammered right now. I said that word too many times. I'm not going to say it anymore. So if you look at the expanded culture of the global game, that sounds a little bit more interesting. If you look at that with the cable options, I've seen every team play at least one game this year between MLB Network, ESPN, TBS with the Sunday afternoon contest, even the Saturday night games that Fox presents. I've seen a decent amount of every team this year, or most of the teams of interest. I'm going to be quite honest with you. I have not watched too many Marlins games or Kansas City Royal games. Sorry, fan bases of those, or Houston Astros. H-Town, much love, but I'm not really breaking your teams down. I'm sorry. But I've at least seen an inning or two. I'm like, okay, I know they exist. But with the cable options, you see all of the teams already. The matchups aren't as much. And signing the cable options, three reasons. Cable options, just delve off on the cable. I have season premiere of Suits tonight, Covert Affairs, and Tattoo Rescue, as well as Ink Master, and The Game on BET, which has kind of fallen off, but I'll glance at it just out of respect. I just named five TV options that I would watch or really be interested in, most likely before the MLB All-Star Game. There are too many options on television, and for every TiVo or on-demand choice, I still have episodes of Ray Donovan and Dexter to catch up on. I still have stuff shows that I have to see. There are too many choices for fans to watch back in the late 80s and early 90s. Literally had, I think, six channels. ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, WOR, and WPIX. Okay, those are my options. I had six channels. They had the Spanish channel, too. So, okay, I had seven. I had seven channels on my TV. That's all. It's the middle of the summer. If I'm home on a Tuesday night, I'm watching the All-Star Game. I may as well. There was no internet. I could have read a book or ran outside. That wasn't happening. So I end up watching all the MLB All-Star Games. So that's where you deal with that issue. So the cable options. Number two, interleague play. I'm not a traditionalist. I like interleague play. I wanted to see something different. I don't like how they have it right now where there's interleague play every weekend that messes with team schedules. Another argument for another day. But the concept of interleague play, Mets are going to play the Royals. Padres are going to face the Texas Rangers. The Baltimore Orioles are going to travel to play Cincinnati. The Braves are going to face, they've played this year, they played Toronto, and you know they've played just different teams. So that's already happened, you know, as far as seeing the different uniforms and the pitching matchups. I mean, there's always one or two interesting matchups that happen, but it's a lot less than it used to be. So those are like the two biggest things as far as the interleague play, the cable, and so those are the issues where it messes with the Major League Baseball All-Star Game. I do like the change of pace, though, with the younger guys being involved. I love seeing Cespedes have his moment last night with the Home Run Derby. I seeing Bryce Harper have his presence felt. Matt Harvey, the Mets phenom, he's starting the game. I like seeing the 25 years old and under guys. And I think, and I need to give credit to the Sports Illustrated article I saw about that, of all the 20 guys 25 years old and under, Manny Machado, 21 years old, similar to Mike Trout and Bryce Hart, all these guys who are major players. And the good part is in some big media markets as well. That's really, and delving into my last point, when Bud Selig is the guest on David Letterman, that's a major, major problem. You have all of these outstanding Major League Baseball talents in the game. Guys who are very personable, very talkative. Brandon Phillips, he talks all day. David Ortiz. There's so many personable Major League Baseball guys in New York for the All-Star Game. And you trot out Bud Selig, the senior citizen. Baseball's two biggest problems. There are a lot of problems. Two of the bigger ones are the regionalization of the sports and the lack of recognizable superstar players. We mentioned the younger guys. I think guys like Trout and Harper and Machado have the chance to, and Matt Harvey, if you look at their situations, they have the chance to be special guys as far as promoting the game. Younger players got the look. I'm going to throw Prince Fielder in there as well. Younger guys who have that youthful energy that you're looking for as being guys who can promote the game in that way. The second problem, regionalization of the game. Down here in Atlanta, you love your Braves, and there's some loyal fans, and that's outstanding. However, Brave fans do not care about the Seattle Mariners. Up in New York, you got some diehard New York Yankee fans. Go to as many games as they can. Watch the Yes Network consistently. They do not give a crap about what the Arizona Diamondbacks are doing. As an NFL fan, I can name the starting quarterback for every single team. If you Seattle Seahawks, Russell Wilson. Green Bay Packers, Aaron Rodgers. Jay Cutler, Chicago. Even Arizona, Carson Palmer, he's going to be the starter. They're trying to work that out. You know, you just go down the line and you look at all the teams. Ryan Tannehill, Miami, the Dolphins, second-year player, trying to rebound from a so-so rookie year. If you look at the way that NFL promotes it, NBA is the same deal. You may not know the entire starting lineup, but you know at least one player on every team. And I mean, I'm an obsessed sports fan, so I'm an extreme example of it. But a lot of casual guys can say, oh, the Atlanta Hawks, they got that Hartford kid, right? Or Sacramento, they have DeMarcus Cousins. He's kind of a so-so. At least they know about other teams in their league. And the reason that matters is that when you get to situations like the Major League Baseball All-Star Game or the postseason, that garners more interest in your game. As I said, being in Atlanta down here as a fan, when the Detroit Tigers faced the Oakland A's in the playoffs, which, you know, is a distinct possibility, Braves fans are going to be less interested in it, unfortunately, because it is a regional game. St. Louis fans love the Cardinals. Midwestern pride represent all day, every day. But they are not following the Marlins. And that's where you run into major issues with the game. And tying it into a major platform like David Letterman, you're going to bring out your older MLB commissioner. And I know CBS has an older demographic, and that's what they kind of go for. But the game is in New York City. It's in Queens. You have the chance to bring out some of the biggest and brightest stars of your game, and you're going to bring on Bud Selig? That's terrible. As a PR executive, I would have fired myself for that decision. And I know there's a lot more that goes into it as far as who the show wants and everything like that. But if I'm a major player in the league, I'm saying, look, bud, you've done your time. You're going to retire sooner rather than later. You need to give that media opportunities to another player. You need to do like Jimmy Fallon did with Matt Harvey. They had a little Q&A, you know, a typical fan in the street, whatever, interaction. Really fun viral segment. That's a good thing. That's what you need to do more often. I do not need to see my older commissioner on a talk show. And that goes for all of them. I don't need to see Roger Goodell on Craig Ferguson. David Stern does not need to be the opening segment on Jimmy Kimmel Live. Okay? Jay Leno does not need Gary Bettman to do the last segment. So it's not a it is a knock on Major League Baseball and Bud Selig. But that's just a general thing that as a media professional, I see that type of stuff and I cringe because I love baseball. To two sports I'll always have love for, no matter what happens, because they were the first two that I follow, are the NHL and Major League Baseball. Those two leagues I will always have a soft spot for because those are the leagues I watched the most as a kid. And it kind of disappoints me when I see the younger generation kids in their, or young adults ages 24 and down, if they don't have a fantasy baseball team, they're not really following Major League Baseball. And that's a really big disappointment. And as I said, just seeing stuff like that with the Major League Baseball All-Star Game really brought a lot of that stuff to full light for me. So those are my thoughts on that. We're going to actually take one more break and then we'll conclude the show here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. You see right through his stormy eyes. You know you have to learn the execution of your mind. You really have to turn. The race is run, the moon is red. All right, let's conclude the show right now here in the Sports Acquired podcast. Thanks for sticking in there and listening to the content. Going to talk about some miscellaneous stuff going on in the life, man. You know, it's been a really interesting few months. Went from kind of struggling to find some employment and get my footing to jumping right into a full-time position working for Neighbor Newspapers, an affiliate of the Marietta Daily Journal here in suburbs of Atlanta. We'll just North Atlanta, just to make it simplify it for those of you not familiar with the geography of Georgia. It's been a really fun opportunity getting a lot of interviews in, talked to a lot of interesting folks, and I've done stories on gymnastics, softball, volleyball, soccer matches, covering that with the Silverbacks. It's been a really fun opportunity for me to professionally and personally getting to see more of the northern Atlanta area, because those are my main markets. I covered DeKalb County as well, which is really near, more close to Atlanta, just outside of it. So personally, it's been really good with the work side of things. Haven't been able to cut too many podcasts or even write as much as I want to, because professionally, you know, you got to focus on that. You got to get your job going and make that happen. But I think I have a good flow right now of what my schedule is with the job, and you're going to record a lot more, especially getting towards when football season starts kicking off. And so that'll mean probably in August, we're going to see a lot more content from me when the NFL and college football kicks, you know, get started in other fall sports. Speaking of college football, I was supposed to be at SEC Media Day this weekend or this week. It started today. Yes, it did start today, going Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of this week. I sent in my paperwork, applied for it, and got rejected. And while I was disappointed in that and honestly a little angry, because I think we're doing some good content here on the sportsinquirer.net, I can understand the fact that they receive thousands of requests literally. And working as a sports information director and seeing how conference offices work and seeing all the requests, when major newspapers from nationally and all the cable networks and reporters, and you have guys from ESPN.com and Fox Sports and other affiliates, when they want to cover it, and then if you, especially if the local newspapers in Arkansas and Mississippi and Alabama, Georgia, and all the other states represented within the SEC, when they need a media credential and Radio Row wants some more affiliates there, the lowly blogger, and I wear that with pride. A lot of people don't like to call themselves a blogger. I'm a sports media blogger. I'm a journalist too, but I'm also a blogger. When someone from my capacity at my level, just starting out, doesn't get a credential, that's okay. I've accepted it, and I use it as motivation to be there next year, because I do plan to be there next year, have my presence felt, because I believe the potential for not only this network of the Sports Inquirer overall, but just the nature of my coverage, the potential is great. Need more dedication on my part to make it better and constantly improve it and evolve it. But I think they're going to see some tremendous growth over the next year. So this time next year, when I make that request, hopefully I can get it granted and get some interviews and get some good digital and written content for all of you out there listening to me. But as I said, it serves as motivation. You have to look at these opportunities or rejections, or maybe not being accepted into something that you wanted, as an opportunity to reevaluate what you're trying to do and to work even harder. That's just the way you have to look at it. So while I would love to be down in Hoover, Alabama, talking to all of the great media people there and talk to all of the coaches and players, it did not work out for me this time, but I think next time it's going to be a little bit better for me. Socially, things have been doing better too. I talked about going over to that hip-hop show over in Terminal West in Atlanta near King's Plow, really fun area. Really starting to expand, maybe because of the job and traveling, really starting to see the city of Atlanta more, not being stuck kind of up in the suburbs of northern Georgia. And while as much love as I have for Ackworth and Kennesaw, and I got family here, and that's cool and everything, you really got to expand your horizons and see a lot of things in your lifetime. So that's kind of what I've been focusing on within the past few months or so while I have not been with you here on the podcast. But as I said, we're going to do a lot more content over the next few weeks, especially when football season kicks into high gear. You're going to hear a lot from me, and I want to hear a lot from you as well. And there are going to be a lot of means for that to happen. So on that note, we're going to get into the final segment of the show, What's Ruffled My Feathers. I was going to talk about Jay-Z's latest album, his Magna Carta, and the presence of older artists in hip-hop and how they're treated in comparison to older artists and other genres of music. But I'm going to switch it up and talk about something that I honestly said I wasn't going to discuss on this show. And unless you've been under a rock and not even acknowledging news in general, we all know about the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman case and the acquittal of George Zimmerman after the death or the shooting of Trayvon Martin and the subsequent reactions from everyone about it. I'm not going to delve into the legal system and whether he was truly guilty or innocent of the crimes that were put against him in court. That's really for another debate for another day. And I have opinions of that. And I don't think that's really an appropriate, this isn't a really appropriate forum to go there with it. What I will talk about, though, is the media coverage of the said events. Last night on Twitter, I'm watching my WWE Raw, watching wrestling, answering emails, reading different articles online, as I always do. And Twitter is blowing up with all of the juror is on CNN. I guess the one of the witnesses was on another show, either on Fox or Fox News or Headline News, one of those things. I just find it saddening that we're allowing the profiting on the death of a young man. The means of his death and the circumstances around it are very much up for debate, but the reality is that a young man or a person, period, died, and you're starting to see all of these news networks profit off of it and just going for that quick advertising buck and getting that exclusive, getting the juror who, and when the jurors has already signed a book deal. I put on my Facebook, that is an embarrassment to mankind. How dare you try to profit off of the murder of an individual or the death or shooting of an individual? It's just a really low point in journalism and for our society. And furthermore, I understand the emotions tied into the case. It's a very tough situation, but I don't think anyone has looked at the reality is that there is a family grieving right now with the death of their son, a brother, and nephew, a family member, and we're looking at this as an opportunity to step on a platform to state our opinions on how this is a step in the positive and negative of the judicial system, or how this is the racial motivation behind the jurors and the entire case is an indictment on America as a whole and everything like that. Take a step back and realize that you are using the death of somebody just to make a point to get your own means and get your own opinions out there. In the end, there's a dead young man who died way too young, and you're looking at this as an opportunity to get a TV appearance or opportunity to write a post about it so you get more hits on your website. The jurors signing the book deal, seeing the witness, I guess she was on one of the shows, I think Anderson Cooper or somebody, and I'm disappointed I even mentioned his name. And I like him as a journalist. He's done a very good job as far as what he does, as far as coverage goes. But the fact that you just allow that to happen just to have her on your show is just disappointing. And as a media member, I know you have to cover the current news. I acknowledge that. And I understand you may have to have your legal experts on there to delve into the actual workings of why that decision was made. But when you have all of these community leaders and activists, and on both sides, you've had people that are saying that Zimmerman should have been guilty, and you have some that said it was self-defense and that he was innocent. I just think you have to, as I said, take that step back and realize that someone he's dead. This isn't like other cases that we debate on the news where it's like, you know, someone may have stole something or someone's maybe drunk or, you know, took some drugs and acted up in that celebrity pop culture stuff that we all follow to different varying degrees. Death is the realest thing out there. That's the, you talk about reality TV and things that are real in life. Death is the realest thing out there. There is no coming back from that. And just seeing the profiting of a young man's death is just very disappointing and has me concerned for our society in general. Once again, thanks for listening to the Sports Inquirer podcast. I've been your host, E. Marcel Portu. As always, go to thesportsinquirer.net for all the latest news and notes from the world of sports and to get all of our podcasts. Subscribe to us on iTunes. We are on there under The Sports Inquirer. Subscribe to us, so every time I do a podcast, it'll upload automatically into your iTunes store. So please do that. We're going to try to do another show on Thursday and delve into more items in the world of sports. If there's anything else you want me to talk about, shoot me an email, tweet me, Facebook me, and everything in between. Until then, have a good fight and a good night.